You're listening to episode 326 of the 200 Churches podcast.
It takes humility. It takes sometimes swallowing your pride when you know you're right and you know the best way to do it, enabling someone else to do it because God has gifted them as well. And when people feel valued in those kinds of situations, it's amazing how the Spirit takes over and their better side comes out, and suddenly they're not trying to get control anymore. They're beginning to relate and understand you as a person, and vice versa. And the church grows in love for one another and its effectiveness in the world when people are really looking, not looking out for their own interests, but looking out for the interests of others.
Welcome to the 200 Churches podcast. We're passionate about providing ministry encouragement to pastors of small churches. We release a brand new episode every Wednesday to do just that for you, all of our small church pastor friends. Now here are two guys who are definitely better together. Friends, pastors, and podcast partners, Jeff and Johnny.
This is the 200 Churches podcast. My name is Jeff Cady. I'm here in the digital sound studio, stuck on the screens with my good friend, podcast partner, former associate pastor, maybe assistant to the pastor, and today campus pastor.
Johnny Craig. I like that, assistant to the pastor. That's
Jonathan. Good to be with you. Welcome to our listeners near and far, around the globe, spanning the globe.
Yes.
To bring us a wide assortment of listeners from every continent on the planet. It's awesome.
I love it. It is awesome. I just think we've been doing this so long that it's easy to, at some point, just forget that we even have listeners. Does that ever happen to you?
You know,
you
the listenership,
just feel like we're just doing this
for as little as we're able to put into it, because, you know, we're both busy in ministry and in family and in life. For as little as we put into this, actually, the listenership is surprisingly strong.
That's
just because
good,
I think that pastors need to hear from normal people who aren't like at the top of the ministry ladder.
Amen.
You know, because it's fun to listen to them, but reality sets in, right? And we're not all going to be hobnobbing around the globe, speaking at this conference and that. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
We're not all, right? Dan Ryland? Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, no, I'm thinking of other people whom I never name, Johnny. I never name.
But Dan Ryland is a personal friend of the show. I'm not besmirching
him. Oh, okay,
I'm just saying.
We're just not all going to be that. And some of us actually have to stay home and pastor our churches, right? In our smaller communities, in our smaller metro areas. Des Moines would be considered a smaller metro area.
Oh, for
sure,
yeah.
I mean, in this country, it's not like a Chicago, New York, or L.A.
This county probably has as many pigs as it has people. I mean, it's a small...
Oh, man. My father would have a joke for that, but my dad, you know, I couldn't...
You're just going to leave it be.
I couldn't repeat it on the pod. This is a Christian production.
That's right.
So
that's right.
I can't do that.
All that to say, we have been at this for a while. We used to do this in the basement of the church we shared together, and there was nobody listening. Now there's several thousand, and we're grateful. We do this for you every single week. And this week, we have a great episode with some folks that we know from Bethel Seminary, where we met. That was our meet cute, Jeff. We had a meet
cute
at Bethel Seminary.
Clue me in on this phrase. You just used a phrase that I think I'm out of.
It's like in a romantic comedy, like the two people meet each other in some like cute way, like they bump into each other and
so it's called a meet cute.
It's called a meet cute. That's
I mean,
right.
I call that a quarter pounder.
That's right.
That's a meet cute to me. Well, I don't have those anymore, but hey.
We had a meet cute.
So we had a meet cute. We had a meet cute in the doorway, Johnny.
We did, yeah. I asked you about Reformed churches and you laughed and said, how do you know that there are Reformed churches in Orange City?
In Orange City.
Yeah, that's right.
I should have laughed and said, oh, yeah, Johnny, you should know all about them since you'll be moving there in a couple of years.
Someday you'll be there.
What?
Oh, man, that's funny.
So, yeah, we got these two guys, Mark Strauss and Justin Irving,
that's right.
Mark is the scholar, the biblical scholar of the two, and Justin is the leadership best practices expert who teaches leadership in the seminary level, and Mark teaches biblical studies in the seminary level, both of them authors. and all around great guys.
Yeah, they were a lot of fun to talk to. Some of these theologian types are a little hoity-toity, but not Mark L. Strauss. Not Mark. He was a good dude.
He had some good stuff to say. When you and I are recording and all of a sudden I'm really, really listening, listening to the point where you're forgetting
you have some to ask a question.
Yeah, at some point you have to have some input.
Yes.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
No, he was helpful.
So these guys put a book together. Johnny, do you remember what the name of the book is? So this has been a couple weeks. The book is actually coming out on June 18th.
Yeah.
I think you can order it on Amazon.
It's called Leadership in Christian Perspective, Biblical Foundations and Contemporary Practices for Servant Leaders. They named it, no offense, that's dry as toast. The content,
seminary level title.
Yeah. The content will be richer than the title.
Well, read the subtitle again. The first two words.
Biblical Foundations.
Yeah, the Biblical Foundations is the Mark Strauss part, and then
Contemporary Practices for Servant Leaders.
Yeah, Contemporary Practices is the Justin Irving part. And
I like
they came together and united in an interdisciplinary way, Johnny,
yes,
to bring the discipline of leadership and the discipline of biblical scholarship, and
yes,
mold them together, because don't we want our leadership to have a biblical foundation to it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, it was a great time. It was a great time. I'm grateful for the time that they put in with us. And I know that you, our loyal and beautiful listeners, will enjoy this conversation with Justin and Mark.
This is the 200 Churches Podcast. My name is Johnny Craig. I am here with my friend and colleague, Jeff Cady. I'm just going to introduce you today. We're going
to. I'm supposed to say my name, Johnny.
Wait, I got to get to the guests. It's not about us.
Stole my lines.
It's about us.
Okay, whatever. Go ahead.
Right. And then our two esteemed guests today. Go ahead and introduce yourself. Start with Mark.
I'm Mark Strauss. I'm a New Testament professor at Bethel Seminary and have been there for 25 years and have the pleasure of writing with my colleague.
It has been a pleasure for me. I'm Justin Irving and teach ministry leadership and lead our Doctor of Ministry program at Bethel Seminary. And I have learned a ton from Mark in this process. Look forward to sharing a bit with you today, Johnny and Jeff.
Very cool. Now, Jeff and I both are Bethel grads, so we think you guys are like the coolest ever because, you know, you taught us how to be pastors and stuff. Well, Jeff, you'd been a pastor. You had to reteach Jeff how to be a pastor.
I had to unlearn a whole lot of stuff.
I had to unlearn. You had to walk. You had to hold his hand through some hard times. But for me, you got to imprint in fun new ways. So it's always a fun thing for us to talk to folks from Bethel.
So, Justin, you were on the podcast. Wasn't it with a guy named Andrew?
Andrew is his name. Yeah, we were talking about a manuscript we had for a book related to the concept of self-differentiation, which I know you and Johnny have spent some time reflecting on, thinking about the value of that for pastors.
That's right. So we've ditched Andrew for Mark today.
Hit the upgrade button. No, no.
So how long have you guys...
Oh, go ahead, Jeff. I was just going to say, I think about self-differentiation a lot. I find myself getting worked up, and I think to myself, this situation is not going to determine how I am going to respond or react. I, within myself, have the capacity. This is literally a thing that I say to myself when I get worked up. So I'm thankful to folks like you, Justin, who have helped me find my way through and become, and on this journey of self-differentiation, I'm a passionate guy. Jeff maybe would use a different word, but I'm a passionate guy, and it's helpful to me, the work that people like you do on this. So thank you. I just want to say thank you for that.
To become a non-anxious presence, Johnny.
Correct.
That's right.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful. So Mark, tell us how it happened that you and Justin got together to write this book.
Yeah. Well, Justin directs the Doctor of Ministry program as well. And so he's out in San Diego, where I've been for most of my career. I really resonate with his work and respect him a lot. And I think that he may remember it differently, but I think the topic of co-writing something came up a number of times. And at one point we sort of started talking about a specific idea, kind of my ideas of leadership. And those ideas really coincided with the work that Justin was doing and with the research, the really empirical research. Mine was sort of my own ideas together with what I was drawing from the biblical text, trying to discern what Jesus was talking about when he talked about leadership. And it so coincided with what Justin was doing and discovering through more empirical studies, contemporary studies, that we came together and decided to write a book together.
Mark, was there scripture that you happened to have been studying, a book or an author in scripture, that you were seeing these principles aligning with what Justin was doing?
Well, I certainly see it in Paul a lot, but really I think the epiphany for me was with Jesus in Mark's gospel. I've written a couple commentaries on Mark's gospel, so have really lived in that gospel for the last decade or so. And Jesus says some extraordinarily radical things that we sort of pass over. We get a bit jaded because we've heard them for so many years, and it's just part of our Christian language. But he says some incredibly radical things about what a leader is to be, something that is completely countercultural. And that really was having an impact on me as I wrote about Mark's theology. And again, that then coincided with some of the things that Justin was researching.
So, Justin, do you have anything to add to that? Does that sound pretty accurate?
It does. Yeah, I actually remember the specific event that kind of the ideas started percolating for me. We had a doctor of ministry intensive, and I had asked Mark to be our chapel speaker that week. And he chose the topic, sort of unprompted by me, of engaging Mark 10 and the discussion of servant leadership that flows out of Jesus's call for his disciples in Mark 10. And he talked for 20, 30 minutes, and I just found myself writing notes and saying to pretty much everything he was articulating, like, yes, 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 this is my vision for how people should be engaging with one another in the life of the church and in the life of organizations. Really is, we use the language of servant leadership that can feel very familiar for us. Really what we're talking about is empowering leadership. How do we view our relationship with others in a manner that's not trying to dominate or control, but really release and empower people? And so Mark was talking about it in the same way that I've gone about studying servant leadership for about 15 years now.
The name of the book is Leadership in Christian Perspective. Let's start out in the negative, because that's how I am. What do you think leadership in a non-Christian perspective is? Like, if you could say, you know, the alternative to your book is what exactly? I mean, what do you think the common ideas of leadership are? I think you alluded to that a little bit just now when you talked about, power and things like that. But just tell me, this is leadership in a Christian perspective. What is this up and against?
Well, let me start, because I'll do the biblical and then Justin will correct me with the research.
Justin will share what he does.
Right. No, yeah. Yeah. Whenever you say biblical, you sort of capture the day, right? So it's not really fair. You won the argument. No, but Mark 10:42, the very passage Justin is talking about, says Jesus says, "You know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them." Leadership, the world's way, is about power, but it's also, if we move forward and what that means, it means I get what I want by using people to accomplish that. I have an agenda. We would say it more like, I have a vision and I can influence people towards that vision. And that sounds very positive, but it really is enlisting people, manipulating people, using people to accomplish your agendas, your goals, your purposes. It's not about what Jesus talks about leadership is, which is empowering others to fulfill their calling, to be all that God has called them to be. And so we have adopted in the church, it seems to me, we have adopted very much the world's model of leadership, which is the most influential, the most powerful, the one who's has the greater following, the larger church, the more books purchased, or whatever, is the one who's the great leader, because they influence people and they get people to follow their agenda. I don't think that's the way Jesus ever described leadership.
Well, when you, you've got a part one, part two, part three here, but you talk about modeling what matters. If it's not power, there's something else that matters. So in that section of your book, what does it talk about modeling?
Justin, you want to take that?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, even just going back to some of the biblical foundations, you think about how Paul used language, you know, follow me as I follow Christ. It's that kind of work that certainly pastors, but other leaders, Christian leaders and organizations need to say, what are the most important things for the people I'm guiding in this community? What's the important mission that we're trying to accomplish as a community? I can't just say to followers, hey, that matters, you go do it. I need to be a person who is modeling the way. I need to be a person who is embodying those priorities.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. Jesus says, right after he says, that's the world's model, he says, not so with you. So the leadership model that we see, the great leaders of the world, I mean, from Alexander the Great to Caesar Augustus and throughout, is power and influence and control. He says, not so with you. Instead of whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, diakonos, and whoever wants to be first must be slave of all, the word doulos. I mean, we're talking about a radical statement here. Jesus says, if you want to lead, you have to become a slave. Well, that would make no sense to the disciples. That would make no sense to anyone hearing him in the first century. A slave was owned by someone. A slave did precisely the bidding of the master. The slave's purpose and goal in life was to please the master, was to enable the master to be everything the master wanted to be. And so how could that be leadership? It would not even sound like leadership until you realize that what Jesus is saying is a slave's role is to empower, to enable, to encourage someone else to be the best that they can be. What we would say, all that God has called them to be, all that God has gifted them to be. So the slave or servant model is one of empowerment, not of power, because a slave has no power. A servant has no power in that cultural context.
I would say that kind of language of not so with you, which was a part of the first century, is also something that we dealt with in the 20th century. So early management theory had a view of followers as essentially negative. They're trying to get away with things, and leaders' primary responsibility is to control them and try to reduce individuality and individual agendas to get them to do what you want them to do. Henry Ford had a line that kind of captured that back in that scientific management era where it says, why is it that I always get the whole person when what I really want is just a pair of hands? So I think Johnny was asking, what's the negative? I think the negative is that type of model. It's the not so with you that was addressed in the first century about the Gentile leadership, but it's also our leadership that we were accustomed to in the early part of the 20th century that needed to control people rather than empower them.
So let's say Pastor Emily has a church of 50 or 60 people, and there's like a dozen families. She's got a leadership team of four lay people, and she's got a couple Sunday school teachers for the kids and two small group leaders. Talk to her for a minute as the pastor, as the leader. How should she view her leadership with the people in her church? What are her like primary responsibilities as a leader who is going to be a servant leader? Because, you know, you would think that your leadership somehow has to take this group to a higher level.
Right.
And
right.
Servant leadership and transformational leadership. So those are sometimes confusing. We might think about of authority or direction to give people. What would you say to her?
I would start with the fact that that church, that little church, has all the spiritual gifts that it needs to flourish. Mm-hmm. And those believers in that church have been gifted by the Holy Spirit to accomplish God's purpose for them individually, for the church, for their families. Her goal is to bring out those spiritual gifts. And that's what empowering is, to enable them to recognize those gifts, to give them the resources, to provide them with the resources to utilize those gifts. It's not about her doing everything. What tends to happen in a smaller church like that is the pastor does everything. They have to, you know, do everything from type up the bulletin to cut the lawn to do the morning and evening services. And this is, I'm describing my father when he was a pastor of a small church.
Sure.
He did absolutely everything. That's not the model. The pastors, the leaders, Ephesians chapter 4, their role is to equip God's people for works of service. To equip God's people. So that's the pastor's role. That's the leader's role, is to help the people discern their giftedness and then empower them, enable them to utilize those gifts to the glory of God.
I love that angle, Mark. That's so biblical, and it's like probably 10%, if that, of how we think about ourselves sometimes as pastors, right, especially in the leadership culture we're in. It's all about being a leader, and leaders, you know, see farther, see first, move faster, you know, all this stuff. But that's, I like that, bringing out the spiritual giftedness in the people in your church. Justin, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, one of the things that I share in classes at times, and we talk about in the book, is this kind of equation, if you will, about the importance of equipping and empowering people. You know, so the ideal is that we are helping to develop the people in our communities. We are equipping them to do the work that God has called them to do. But then we need to move from that equipping to actually releasing people. And I think that's where a lot of pastors, maybe the Emilys in the church world, are sometimes tripped up. There's a desire to maintain the control, and it's not, I wouldn't say it's typically in a selfish sense of wanting to maintain control, but wanting the quality of the ministry to continue to flourish and grow. There's not the full releasing at times. And so we need this equipping and empowering to go hand in hand for people to really flourish. So if you have people who are equipped but not empowered, that leads to frustration because they've been trained, they've been given a sense of what their gifts are, but they're not using those the way that they fully can. Similarly, if you have people who are empowered but not equipped, the challenge is that you end up with failure that can come about in those scenarios. So leaders really do need to think about that Ephesians 4 model in the church and say, how am I, yes, equipping them, helping to bring some direction, but then releasing them into that direction as well and not bottlenecking decisions at each step of the way.
That's really good.
I'm thinking through a situation that I find myself in sometimes, and I think it ties into what we're talking about right now. I will interact with folks in my church, and I will see giftings in them and even passion in them. But I think, oh, these people are busy. They have busy lives. And if I engage them in the work of the church, am I pulling them away from their family? Am I just loading extra burden on them? Am I, at my worst moments, just trying to get them, and am I Henry Fording them and just trying to get labor out of them and not actually, you know, helping them as people? And I struggle sometimes to make the ask to get people involved. And I feel like that's probably a huge part of leadership. Speak to a pastor who might be in that kind of situation as well, where they almost feel guilty asking people or drawing people into ministry, that Ephesians 4 life, because, you know, you don't want to add more burden to people's lives.
See, Johnny uses the podcast for free coaching and counseling. So speak to Johnny about this. And I'll listen in too, by the way.
Other pastors named Johnny. Speak to all the pastors named Johnny listening right now.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, I'm sure Mark has some good things to say to that as well, but I'll jump in with one comment. I think that's the real win behind a transformational leadership theory. What I mean by that is the way that transformational leadership is talked about at times is, how are you creating leaders and followers who are mutually owners of the mission of the organization or church? I think that sometimes we're hesitant in asking people to jump in and do things, because really at the end of the day, we feel like we're owners of the vision and other people are just renters doing what our bidding for that community.
Right.
What we need to do is really do some work ahead of time and say, how are we nurturing a vision that collectively, the pastor who does receive some remuneration from the church and every other member of the body of Christ in that community, they are owners. They are in. This is their community. And when people really have that sense of ownership, I think that hesitancy of asking goes away.
Yeah, I would just totally agree with that. When I'm leading, I say I want to protect my followers, but what I really often mean is that, you know, I really do it better. And if I give it up, then really it's not going to get done to the kind of quality that I want it to be done. And so I'm really clinging to power, clinging to ownership of that, because I don't want to relinquish control. I'm not saying that's always the case, but I think we need to examine ourselves, because what we're doing by not encouraging the giftedness of others is we're taking away their joy. I mean, really, we find greatest joy in the Christian life in utilizing, exercising our spiritual gifts. That's what we are created to be. That doesn't mean being over busy and you know, being at the church every night and sacrificing family for that. The pastor or layperson can do that. We don't want that. But if you take away or don't enable and encourage the spiritual gifts of your individuals, you're taking away one of the greatest sources of joy, which is to serve God by utilizing the gifts that he's given you.
Yeah. So I think this is a larger discussion too, Johnny, this modeling what matters, because Justin talked about creating a culture or a framework for understanding involvement, you know, ownership versus renting. But also, you know, how are we teaching our people to live their lives in such a way that they prioritize what matters most in terms of family? If, in other words, if they're always running at the ragged edge, they don't have time not just for church stuff, not just to serve, but to live their lives the way they want to live them. And honestly, that's a hard thing that we as pastors have to deal with these days, is teaching and operating against the grain of the crazy, busy society that we live in. It's a larger conversation and teaching that, when done, kind of alleviates a little bit off of this area. You guys also talk about understanding relational skills, leadership and Christian perspective, relationships. What types of things do you guys get into in the book regarding relational skills and leadership?
We talk first and foremost about just the fact that leadership in and of itself is inherently a relational practice. You don't do leadership without being understanding how to engage with people well. Mark starts off that chapter with a really, really powerful story about a conflict that emerged in a church that he was providing leadership to. Mark, I wonder if you'd share that relational lesson from that story.
We love conflicts.
Well, I was preaching. I was the interim pastor of a church, and I said something that really offended an older gentleman in the church. He wanted to talk about it, and so he came over to my office, and we started to talk, and I realized he was really angry. He was really hot about this, and instead of jumping into the issue, I just started asking about him and his family. And he started telling me about his family and his life and his grandchildren. And we had the most wonderful time together, just building a relationship, ultimately praying together. And he became my strongest supporter in that church. I was in that interim for a long time. And he was, and is an, to this day, is a great encourager for me. And it was because, instead of winning the argument, I could have won. He was wrong, you know, from my perspective, he was wrong. I could have demonstrated that and showed him, and, you know. But instead, I said, I don't care about that. What I care about is the relationship. At least this is what I did. Just built the relationship. And the issue we talked, I don't know that we ever got to the issue that I so offended him on. That wasn't really the issue. The issue was, once we built the relationships, he realized I cared for him. I realized he cared for me, that we wanted the best in the other person, which is the essence of relationships, I think. And so it really melted a hard heart in many ways by building that relationship. We built a bit of trust between us, which became the foundation for a very strong relationship.
We get into some of these similar themes in the third section of the book, talking about accountability and the nature of providing support as well. As we're working with people, you have to have openness and support to go hand in hand. So if I don't have a relationship where someone feels cared for and supported, they're not going to oftentimes receive the correction or accountability that's brought into that relationship. There needs to be a sense of support that lays a foundation, a love of relationship. And then out of that sense of love and relationship, then we can have honest conversations about things that are happening or not happening and how we can grow as a community.
Let's just say there were this pastor who was maybe a year and a half into his new ministry, and the church, let's just say, they decided that they wanted to focus on the younger adults in the community so that they could backfill their congregation with people that would take it on into the coming decades. And let's say that in planning some changes, some of the older people, because you guys talk about understanding the priority of people, some of the older people who on whom the church was built essentially felt disenfranchised and, you know, kind of kicked to the curb. And so discussion was begun with them, and, you know, well, why can't we, you know, we have both, why can't there be a focus on us and on younger people? And so if we're going to understand the priority of people, but then also make decisions to move us toward the vision, how should said pastor be thinking philosophically, you know, leadership philosophy about the elder members of the church? How should that pastor think about that situation, and what should he or she do or not do?
I think the answer is in Scripture, clearly. And one of the things is to honor all members of your church, and particularly your senior members of the church. So finding a way to honor them and to make them aware of how much they've contributed, how important they are. And the model of Scripture of discipleship or mentoring fits this perfectly, because the older men are to encourage and teach the younger men. So finding a way to utilize those members to train up and empower the younger members seems to be crucial there. And it's the family model, essentially, in the church, that your older members become the models and examples for your younger members.
I would throw in, too, that sometimes the process that we use to have these discussions has honor woven into it or dishonor woven into it. I think about, we share this story, I think it's in chapter 3, talking about collaboration. We share an example from a friend of ours who was a pastor in a church in Pennsylvania. And he was reading in the 90s about, I think he had read some book probably from Barna or something on vision. And he decided, oh, we need to get some vision as a church. And they hired a consultant, and the board went off to meet with this consultant, and they came up with their Vision 2000 plan. The congregation had their annual meeting, voted to approve it. The challenge was that vote that was almost unanimous was essentially, sure, pastor, go ahead and do your vision. Mm-hmm. And as they were living it out, there wasn't traction that took place. Mm-hmm. And Dave was his name, a friend of ours. He went into a process really of kind of confessing before the Lord and his congregation that he hadn't really attended to the community in that conversation. It was really just a board off on their own, heading up to Mount Sinai, coming up with the vision, without really engaging what's in the heart of the people with whom the Spirit of God dwells. And so they went back in a process of really hearing people's voices and concerns and allowing those voices and concerns to become a part of a shared vision for the decade ahead. And it really began to come alive for that community. And it's back to that, are they renters or owners? But they had a process to nurturing that sense of ownership. And you had multiple generations saying, yes, we want in on this, because they had a chance to share their concerns and perspectives. I remember Patrick Lencioni had a phrase at one point saying, people don't inherently need to get their way, that they do need to have their way considered thoughtfully and part of the conversation. I think in a church like the one you're talking about, how are people authentically being heard? And I think once they're able to share their perspectives, a lot of times you can come to some common ground and find ownership along the way.
Oh, that's really good. Very helpful.
I like the way you guys talk about church members. I think a lot of times pastors, not me or Jeff, obviously, but pastors, can have almost a negative, these sheep that I got to drag along. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Sure. Jeff and I are part of this big sprawling Facebook group, small church pastor. And some of the things that get posted in that group blow my mind. Like, people talking about their congregation, and that these people just sound completely intractable. Like, just like, who are these people? Why won't they do anything? It's refreshing to me to hear you guys talk about church members that way. But I do wonder, does this stuff work in every situation? Is there ever a time where you run into someone who is too obstinate, or too a church that is too set in its ways? I mean, is there a limit to what this type of leadership can actually do? Is there a point where you just throw up your hands and burn it down?
I think there is. I mean, there are church cultures that are intractable, but cultures change only when there's pervasive modeling in the culture. So modeling of humility, true humility, where you're really looking out for the other person. I mean, Paul says it, in Philippians 2, do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. In humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. There's the model leadership right there. It's actually demonstrating by your life and your actions that you're really in it for the other person. it's hard to be angry with someone who's sitting there praying for you and, you know, trying to encourage you. But that takes a cultural change. And sometimes patterns are, you know, there's a church boss maybe, or there's an elder board that is intractable. Patterns are so well established that they're going to eat the servant leader alive in that context. But in time, through modeling, I think you can change a church. You can often change a church culture. In other cases, I think the pastor has to realize, I have to move on. I have to find a place where, you know, people want to partner with me rather than control the situation.
This might be a dangerous question, but what does your book bring to the leadership discussion that other books aren't bringing right now? You know, how is your book set apart? Other than the fact that it was written by Mark and Justin, what is the salient philosophy or thesis of the book that sets it apart from other books?
I would say that in some way it does relate to Mark and I, not us as persons, but the fields that we represent. So the real uniqueness of the book is that you can find a number of books out there that provide a biblical and pastoral reflection on leadership. You can also find books out there that engage scholarship and what's happening, what's been demonstrated empirically to work in the field of leadership. But there's not, at least we didn't find a book that really brought those together seriously into a serious conversation. And so it is the integration of Mark and I's fields that is sort of the novelty of this particular offering.
Okay, and define those two fields again for our listeners.
Well, Mark is a biblical scholar, and so he focuses on doing sound biblical exegetical work and providing explanation of biblical scholarship in very accessible ways. That's kind of his niche in writing. My field is looking at leadership studies based upon best practice in the field of leadership, theory and research. So not just, hey, in my experience, this works. There's lots of books that have that tone to them. This is not a, hey, in Justin's experience, this works. This is, what does the field of leadership say? What does research support as being effective for our communities?
You guys should probably think of teaching in a seminary at some point, or maybe using this as a seminary textbook.
That's a good idea. I think we should think about that.
Janine Brown was on our podcast talking about integrated studies before, wasn't she, Jeff?
Yeah.
I was just with Janine earlier. She's really into integration. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she was saying how disciplines cannot integrate, but people, their ideas can be integrated.
Oh, very good, very good.
Yeah, because disciplines are disciplines, right?
Yeah.
Dig into integration. That's good. I like that.
Let me just add one thing to what that cross-disciplinary approach is crucial. And I think that is unique about the book and its best selling point, I think. But I think also we go beyond what some books that espouse servant leadership do, because it seems like servant leadership is often still a means to getting what you want done. Whereas the empowering model is recognizing that the Holy Spirit really is the guiding force in the church. And that if you empower God's people and release them and free them to do what God has called them to do, then the church is going to flourish. And suddenly you're not always getting your way, because your way may not be exactly where God wants to lead the church. So I think that going one step beyond sort of acting like a servant to get what you want is another unique aspect of the book.
Mark, did you write the commentary on Mark for the exegetical commentary on the New Testament?
Yeah, the Zondervan exegetical commentary. That's
Yeah. So you wrote that. A lot of leadership books, you know, you got Christians who are leaders and they write leadership books and they use leadership principles and they're Christians. But what you guys are talking about is, you know, what Jesus said about being a servant leader. You are taking, Mark, from your perspective, the biblical text and the teachings of Christ and saying, okay, how does this impact and inform what, Justin, you are finding as best practices in leadership today? That is really, I feel like this is really healthy, a very healthy perspective for a pastor to be able to learn leadership and not lose his or her soul in doing that and in implementing.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great way to put it. I couldn't have said it better. Yeah, I agree.
Time is wrapping up. I think that this is the time, Jeff, where we say, do you have a parting thought for small church pastors? Obviously, you guys are working in seminaries, and you don't work in a seminary for the money. You do it because you love the church and you love church leaders. And that's why you write a book like this as well. So do you have just a final word of encouragement for the small church pastors who are listening?
I would say keep a posture of openness and learning. One of the things that we talk about early on in the book is that effective leaders are those who engage in honest self-evaluation, which is just saying we need to constantly be open to the fact that we might not have it all right. So back to that Mark 10 passage that Mark was talking about as a foundation of servant leadership discussion. The start of that passage essentially is James and John thinking they get it, but they don't. And I think that's oftentimes the case as we're going through our own leadership. We can be blind to our blind spots. Mm. And how can we recognize those places where we maybe really are holding on to power more than we should, thinking, oh, that's just a mega church pastor problem. I think it's a human problem. We need to embrace this journey of humility and learning to see the gifts in others and empower them in a very robust way.
Very nice. How about you, Mark?
Absolutely. Well, for 30 years or so, I've been working with pastors and leaders and have seen a lot of churches in crisis. I've never seen a church in crisis that was in crisis because of false teaching, because of heresy. I'm sure that's an issue. It certainly was at times in the New Testament. It's always been the same thing. It's always been about power. It's about someone has the power or someone is offended by someone who's exercising their power. And it becomes a struggle for who's going to take control. And if we could just reverse that to how can I enable you to do what God has called you to do? It takes humility. It takes sometimes swallowing your pride when you know you're right and you know the best way to do it, enabling someone else to do it because God has gifted them as well. And when people feel valued in those kinds of situations, it's amazing how the Spirit takes over and their better side comes out. And suddenly, they're not trying to get control anymore. They're beginning to relate and understand you as a person and vice versa. And the church grows in love for one another and its effectiveness in the world when people are really looking, not looking out for their own interests, but looking out for the interests of others.
Very good. Well, guys, Johnny, I just decided you and I are going to do an outro. We don't need to do an intro, but we'll do an outro and
okay.
Wrapping it up a little bit and then some application. Because this is really good.
That's really good, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
So guys, the book is Leadership and Christian Perspective, and the launch date is what day?
June 18th.
June 18th. So we're going to have this release as close to June 18th as possible.
Great.
And just want to encourage pastors, you know, if you don't want fluff and stuff, and if you want something with sound leadership principles and strong biblical scholarship, get the book Leadership and Christian Perspective by Irving and Strauss. Hopefully it will become, you know what, 60 years from now, they'll be saying, yeah, did you read the leadership book by Irving and Strauss? Irving and Strauss. That'd be awesome. Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Your time. Yeah.
Great to be with you.
Well, there it is, Johnny, the authors of Leadership in Christian Perspective. I mean, yeah, you and I might have changed the title to make it a little more salacious and a little more clickbait. But Leadership and Christian Perspective is going to deliver on the title with
yes.
Mark and Justin.
You can trust a couple PhDs to write a good book. That's what I think. I mean, they are speaking out of a wealth of wisdom and experience, and they are both experts in their field. And so when they get together, as you said, and do an interdisciplinary book, it's worth paying attention to. So I think it's going to be great.
Speaking of interdisciplinary, this has nothing to do with it, by the way. But last night I'm in an elders meeting.
Yeah.
And I share about how one of our elders had heart surgery. And it was this oblation surgery where they go in and they like kill parts of the heart that is misfiring so that it won't misfire anymore. And it stops that tachycardia stuff. So this guy was in and they go in through the veins, you know, and they do it. They don't like cut through the chest or anything. And this guy had it done. It was a 6-hour surgery. One of my other elders says, yeah, the guy who developed and pioneered that surgery was my roommate in college.
Shut up.
And so he starts talking about the guy, how the guy got a degree in neurology. Neurology. And then he decided he needed to get a different kind of a degree because there were things he had to do that he had in his head that he couldn't accomplish without it. So he went into the MD PhD program. I said, the
like
what?
Like you do. Yeah.
Yeah, right. He says, the MD PhD, well, you get an MD and a PhD in the same program.
As one does.
I'm like,
yeah.
Okay. And so this guy was saying, you know what? I think I could, there's got to be parts of the heart. And so this other elder, he explains the whole thing. So then I go to visit today with the elder that had heart surgery.
Yeah.
And he names the first name of his doctor. And it was actually the other elder's former roommate. It was the guy who pioneered
the guy
that procedure.
Did it?
The guy did it for
now
him.
That's money in the bank. When you get the guy who made the surgery up to do the surgery, you're in good hands.
6-hour surgery. He said he's a little eccentric and a little quirky.
That's okay.
The guy's a genius. His first name is Frank. So I think because that was his first name, he had to really work hard in life to kind of overdo his first name. I mean, no offense to anybody named Frank. I mean, Pastor Frank, no offense to you, of course.
All you average guys out there named Frank.
Average Franks. To be frank about it, right?
Just start the hate mail now.
That was a rabbit trail, all talking about Justin and Mark's PhDs. But
yeah.
Johnny, we were talking about self-differentiation,
yes,
and the ability to lead others and not to get caught up in the drama of those that you lead, but also not to detach yourself from the leadership relationship. The ability to do that and the ability to respond to situations without reacting in the moment.
Yes. And I think it's something, when was the first time we learned about this? It might have been from Justin. I mean, a few years ago. I remember the first time I was hearing these terms, self-differentiation.
Oh.
It was it's that book. It's the book. What's the book?
Yes, Freed.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Freed. That's, I know what you're talking about.
Yes. It was called, it's called a nerve. Something
failure of nerve.
Failure
yes.
of nerve.
Failure of nerve.
Yes.
Yes. And that book, he talks about self-differentiation, which is something I had never heard of before. And we talked about that on a podcast. And I feel like it just changed. It just made me so aware of controlling myself in situations. And maybe that's part of age too. But I think you have to be aware in a situation that things aren't going to go your way. There's going to be anxiety. There's going to be tension. There's going to be conflict. And you have a responsibility as a leader to stay in that space, to stand in that space, but not to allow the anxiety and the conflict to impress upon you and be in a reactive state to that anxiety. That is maybe the most important and yet the most difficult task for a leader. Counterpoint, Jeff?
No counterpoint, but it was episode either 198, 199, or 201.
Okay.
That we had
Janine Brown.
Janine Brown on the podcast, and
yeah,
she co-authored something with a guy whose name I don't remember, but it was all about the self-differentiation piece,
yeah,
and leadership, the interdisciplinary activity, you know, of the discipline of psychology and theology.
Yes.
And that was a great episode. So if you go back to one side or the other of episode 200, which was,
yeah,
of course, N.T. Wright.
Oh, yeah. Let's just name drop that one more time. Absolutely.
Yeah, right. But that one with Janine Brown was really, really helpful. Very thought-provoking.
She's amazing. Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, goes right to the heart of leadership and to the heart of the leader.
It's $1.99. It's $1.99.
Okay.
Yep.
And what's the name of that episode?
Mixing Theology and Psychology in Pastoral Ministry.
Oh, what a name. Now after you listen to this episode.
We know how to get clicks, baby.
Right. Oh, yeah. We do this all the time so well. What was the name of that guy way back when? No, episode 199. One of my favorite episodes. It really is.
It's
one
great.
Of my favorite. And you were talking, Johnny, about one that you did last summer. What's the lady's name that you did
yes.
it with?
Pam Dykstra. Yeah.
Pam Dykstra.
Yeah.
Yes.
She leads Crucial Conversations training.
And so if you search 200 Churches, Pam, Crucial Conversations,
yeah,
Johnny, that was a money episode if there ever was one.
Yeah,
and I think you told
absolutely.
Me it was just you and her, and I think you told me you hardly had, and I could tell, you didn't have to even edit that episode. It was so It was so good.
She was
on
just
the first
like ready. She was just ready to go. It was really something to sit there with her and listen to her just go through the content of the class. I mean, we were talking beforehand, just having her back on because she just did such a great, great job. And the crucial conversation stuff is so important because it's all about how to work through conflict. It's all and so instead of avoiding conflict, it's about how to work through conflict. It's about embracing in some way conflict so that you can get to the other side. And that was great, great content with Pam. And I'm grateful for her being on as well.
So, pastors, if you're having any leadership challenges right now, and usually leadership challenges are relationship challenges. They're dealing with, first of all, yourself and then dealing with others. We just named off some. Did you look at what episode number that was with Pam Dykstra?
I'm trying to find it
okay.
right now.
So, but if you go to episode 199, that's an awesome episode to listen to. The one you just listened to and then the one last summer with Pam Dykstra. Yeah. Which is episode 288. These things deal with stuff, Pastor, that we have to look inside of ourselves and say,
absolutely,
how am I doing as a leader? And this isn't the easy, quick fix type of stuff, nor is it, get a book or take your people through this or that. This is really saying, how am I wired as a leader? How am I wired, psychologically, emotionally?
Yeah.
How am I handling myself? How am I relationally with others? And to what degree am I willing to invest some capital and some elbow grease into making myself a better person and a better leader? And these episodes, did you say 288?
288,
199.
Yep.
Today's episode 326. And there are others. I wish I had them off the top of my head. But if you scroll through,
we've got
300 plus episodes here. We've got a number of episodes about this. It's self-leadership. But I was just listening to the latest John Maxwell podcast episode.
Okay.
And he was on there talking about how leadership, accomplishing anything, is involving self-discipline. And self-discipline is uphill. It's all uphill. There's no plateau. There's no downhill. It's all uphill. And he was saying it, 15 different ways that, John says, I'm always writing. I'm always starting a book.
Writing. Filing.
I'm always writing a book. And I'm always finishing a book. I'm always writing. I'm working on three books all the time. And he said, always? Yes. Always. Always three books. Well, how often do you write, John? Every day.
Every day.
Well,
every day.
But every day. Every day. Every day I write. Every day I file. And every day I read. Right?
Classic,
I read, I write, and I file.
I read, and I file.
His point is that there's no downtime in leading ourselves. And so these things are self-differentiation, providing a non-anxious presence as a leader. These things are so important. And John said something today that I think all the time. The hardest person he's ever had to lead is himself.
Yeah.
Right?
That's actually really helpful.
True for all of us.
That's helpful to hear you say. It's helpful to hear a guy like that say because he has done so much and we think it comes easy.
It doesn't.
I love hearing that because sometimes I work on myself for a little bit and get tired of it and then stop. And for him to say, well, you never don't get tired of it.
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's it. That's your life, is you're doing that.
And you're never not the hardest person to lead in your life.
That's actually oddly encouraging to me.
He said, here's another thing he said. And by the way, go ahead and listen to the John Maxwell podcast. I don't know, John Maxwell Leadership Podcast, maybe is what it's called, the most recent one. He said, it's easy to teach leadership. He went off on that for a while. I can do that all day, every day. He goes, it's easy to teach. It's hard to live.
Yep.
It's easy to write about and read, but it's hard to do, and even for him. So
that's a good word.
Well, good episode, Johnny, a good episode because we find good guests. And
that's it.
We attach them to our good listeners.
Oh, I thought you were going to say to our good selves, but yes, our good listeners. Good guests, good listeners.
We're the only outliers in the equation, Johnny.
We're the downside of the podcast.
We're just the messengers, right? We're just bringing the information.
100%. That's right.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for hanging out, Jeff, and thank you to our listeners for hanging out with us. We love it. We love you, and we'll be back next week with a hot and fresh new episode of the 200 Churches podcast.
My name is Angela, and I want to thank you for listening to this episode. If you haven't already, you should subscribe to our weekly email at 200churches.com and to the podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You know it. We'll be back next week with another amazing and encouraging episode just for you. Until then, may God bless you as you lead and love His church.
Yeah. Well, that first class.
How many years is that now?
It'll be 9 years.
9 years.
Isn't that funny? 9 years, like, man. Back when I was young, back when I was only 47 years old, some of my hair was a little darker.
You're like the third longest by choice relationship I have in my life.
Kayla.
Derek, my friend Derek.
Derek.
Jeff.
That's funny.
That's funny. All right, let's put a bow on this thing.
Okay, man. It was as phony as a $5 bill. I mean a $3 bill.
We gave a lot of $5 bills away. We did do that.
That's right. That's right. My father-in-law used to say that.
Cash.
We'd always laugh. That guy's as phony as a $10 bill. We'd always want to say, that would be like a $7 bill, Skip. Okay. So different.
There are $10 bills. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Okay. What's the name of it again?
Leadership in Christian Perspective.
Okay. All right.